Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Dhammacakka Sutta, which we recited this evening, this is something which really always touches my heart whenever we chant it. It's something terribly moving and significant about this, the recreation of that moment when the Buddha's dispensation began. In the chant itself, after the Buddha has given this talk, then it describes how the earth quaked and the 10,000-fold universal system shook and quaked and rocked, and the great measureless light surpassing the beauty of the gods spread throughout the world. And one can feel a small echo of this in one's heart as we chant this, as we go back to that moment of the first transmission, the first understanding of the Dhamma, the conveying of the Buddha's insight to other people. And because at that moment also, we have in the sutta, is the Buddha realizing that Kandanya, one of the bhikkhus with him, had understood. He could see into his mind and realize that Kandanya had understood the teaching. The other four had not at that time, but he could see that within Kandanya, the eye of Dhamma, the Dhamma Chaku, the eye of Dhamma had opened. He understood how things are. He saw the truth, the path. And then you get one of these great inspired exclamations of the Buddha. Kandanya knows. But, one can feel empathy, that cry from the heart of, you know, how wonderful someone understands. The eye is open, we can see. And so from that time forth, that monk's name was changed from Kandanya to Anya Kandanya, Kandanya who knows. And there's this little incident, this replaying of this night in the deer park in Benares. These half a dozen ragged monks sitting, gathered together. What an earth-changing, a world-shattering little scene that was, just unbeknownst to the people half a mile away, 100 yards away, little cluster of monastics. But yet at that moment there was something happened which has transformed the lives of millions of people since that time. Right up until today, where we in this little group of people gathered here together in this place for these weeks of a contemplation, these weeks of living together as a group, that we inherit the result of that moment. That was the moment that the Sangha, the monastic community, began, because Kandanya's response to the eye of Dhamma opening was immediately, you know, "I would like to become your disciple." And he asked to be officially accepted as a disciple, as one of the Buddha's family, one of the Buddha's children. He was born of the Dhamma. And so all of us, all this time later, all these centuries further on, we are part of that same family. We too have entered upon that same path, become a part of that same group. And we inherit the blessings, the benefits, the treasures of that family, of the Buddha's family. We are, being children of the Buddha, we inherit the Buddha's legacy. The existence of the Sangha is something that is as we describe in the chanting that we do, is this unsurpassed field of merit, bringing occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world. This is something that it's good to contemplate. What is the important thing about Sangha? Why is Sangha? Why is existing together as a group? Why is that so important? What's such a big deal about it? How come just a group of people who live simply together, who observe kindness and restraint and so forth, how come this is such a blessing? Why is this an incomparable field of merit, such a fertile ground for goodness to develop in? Why is this such an important thing for the world? Well, for myself, I can see that if I didn't have like-minded companions to help me in the spiritual life, I never would have gained remotely the kind of understanding or what peace of mind that there is here in my life, that it would be impossible to really develop any kind of maturity, any real spiritual qualities, without the presence and the companionship, the support of like-minded people. When I was in my teens and growing up, going to university, and during those times, I was always very interested in mystical things, in the inner aspects of religion and understanding. This was something that was tremendously important to me, to understand what lay behind everything, what was the essence, the meaning. And I thought about these things a lot and figured out a lot of things, understood things intellectually in quite a profound way that astonished myself, that I could get into intense extended discussions on amazingly esoteric, profound, abstruse philosophical points for hours on end, and be kind of blazing with with interest and and a clear seeing, clear understanding. But yet, alongside that, there was also tremendous emotional turbulence, uncontrolled anxieties and fears, passions, that were all swashing around in my mind along with everything else. And even though there was, a longing for truth or a strong spiritual impulse there from a young age, still the confusion coming from instinctual desires and fears and insecurity and unclarity meant that all of the spiritual impulse, the attraction towards truth and goodness and wisdom, understanding that was there, and the true, the valid understanding, valid insight that was there, it all just became confused and corrupted and sidetracked and taken up with secondary, unnecessary things, or get just drawn into being lazy or complacent or just choosing distraction, choosing oblivion rather than knowledge, than the good way. Now, all the way along, I think one of the things I always cherished dearly in my life was the quality of harmony, of friendship. But I found that was a tremendously important ethic in my life, of being friendly, being a force of concord, a force of harmony between people, being always ready to help out and to be a good friend, to be one who delighted in creating connections, bonds, forming friendship. And I would always feel very very hurt by people who were unfriendly or aggressive, or who were determined to conflict. And I found that when I came into contact with the Sangha, when I was traveling, I'd finished a university. I was been studying at London University, and when my degree was finished, then I took the opportunity to leave England and to head off into the East on my spiritual quest, which is the place to go. So I headed east, and up until that point, I'd always felt that just making my own kind of piecemeal spiritual path was quite sufficient. I wasn't consciously looking for any kind of institution or group to belong to. I had quite strong anti-establishment feelings. I always felt that just to be a free spirit was the ideal, just to follow your love wherever she leads you, as Khalil Gibran put it. Well, my love was leading me to all kinds of disastrous places, and so even my efforts to try and live a free and spiritual existence, even the trying to maximize on the qualities that I respected, and being harmless, friendly, kind, generous, etc., that this didn't seem to help me a great deal with the amount of confusion that was in my mind, and also just spending time amongst people whose values were very worldly, that were based upon just amusement, upon distraction, upon worldly goals and aims, and that just having a nice philosophy some nice, you know, nice ideas or nice principles that you felt that you believed in, but without really having a way of developing that, without really having something that helps that to be actualized, then I found all of my nice ideas and my aspirations were wasted, were lost, were just being burned up. And I began to feel quite a lot of despair, and not knowing what to do. I seemed to be doing all of the right things according to my own sort of formula, my own, what I'd figured out was the right and the best thing to do with my life. I was doing everything that I could imagine was right, but yet the result was extremely painful, disappointing, and unsettling. I was very insecure, confused. Then coming into contact with the Sangha, I found that the quality of harmony or friendship was the very basis of the existence of that community. That just the very word Sangha means those who are together, that which is together, that which is formed. And its whole essence is a group of people joining together, separate individual people joining together in perfect harmony, so that even though they are many, they act as one. As one mind, as one spirit. And so that the initial attraction towards the Sangha that I found was that here is a group of people who are really putting into action the spirit of what I respect and I find most important and precious in life. They're people who are learning to live harmoniously with each other. Then the other aspects of Sangha life, the qualities of renunciation and devotional practices, adherence to rules and so forth, those things were all very secondary. And I didn't really take them in very much at first, because what was most striking, was most important, was this communal spirit, the training of the heart to live as one, to be able to live as one, harmoniously with others, and this is what really caught my interest, caught my enthusiasm, and drew me into the community. This was slightly unusual. I found, as I stayed there, because most of the other people in the Sangha had been people who were interested in meditation, or who wanted to find a teacher, or who had read lots of Buddhist books or had studied Buddhism before and wanted to kind of go and experience life as a monastic. But for me, that all of that was stuff that came later, and this spirit of community was what I really longed for. And that the reading that we had this morning about the Buddha meeting with the Anuruddhas after leaving the quarreling monks of Kosambi in disgust, being fed up with the monks of Kosambi, so full of their own, the importance of their own arguments, they couldn't even hear the advice of their own teacher, the Sammasambuddha himself. And then the three Anuruddhas living in the forest together. How beautiful. These people just training themselves to give up what they like to do individually for what is right, what is good for the whole group. as friendly and undisputing as milk with water. So I found for myself, coming to live at the monastery in Thailand as a lay person, then as an anagarika, I came in on rather a strange footing, like not going there to find a teacher, not looking for a particular guide, but instead just looking for a spiritual community, because I suppose I knew that in my heart that's what I needed more than anything else, was an environment in which to make use of the potential that was there within myself, that I could see that a lot of the good things that were within me and were within other people were just being wasted. I mean, I remember, being wasted was a condition that was sought after. One paid a lot of money to achieve through ingestion of various illegal substances, one sort or another. That to get wasted, to be wasted, was something that one spent a lot of time doing. And it wasn't until I really started to contemplate what I was doing, and when I'd started to meditate, that I realized that how foolish to waste oneself, and that the ethic of the hedonistic lifestyle of myself and much of my peer group was actually devoted towards being wasted. Wasting what we have. And I could see this was a tragedy. This was something very tragic and sad, and could only lead to sorrow, to unhappiness and disappointment in the end. So the beauty of a Sangha is that we have people around us who are like-minded, that can support us, can encourage us with their presence. Now, first of all, one always feels that, particularly if you come from a Western background, that one is generally a blight upon the planet, that one is not doing anything worthwhile. I remember being at the International Monastery, and just my mind was just incessantly thinking and full of unspeakable thoughts and passions and worries, and my imagination would go wild virtually non-stop, just thinking about this and thinking about that, and I used to feel very guilty about receiving people's offerings. And as a Western monk, even as an anagarika, the people are so devoted and so incredibly kind and generous towards you. All the people in the village would call you Ajahn as soon as you shave your head. Let alone, even before you're wearing white, they start calling you Ajahn. They're terribly respectful and incredibly supportive, and they'd die for you. They would give up their lives for you, and without hesitation. Some of them you feel with such intense affection and respect for you, and you think, if they just knew what was going on in my mind, they'd be absolutely horror struck. And I would express these kind of reservations and feelings to the monks there, and say, you know, I really feel this is, you know, a bit of a sham. You know, these people think that we're all so sacred and pure and holy, and you know what's going on in my mind is pretty profane. But then you realize that it's not like Stuart was saying earlier today, a monasteries are not for saints, they're for sinners. That if we were all in pure, totally pure enlightened beings, there wouldn't be any need for monasteries. You know, the monasteries are here for those who have a potential and a lot of defilements and confusion. This is what monasteries are for. So that the potential that is there actually has a chance to ripen, to grow and to develop. And that if we feel that as soon as we shave our head, or we come and stay in a monastery, that we're supposed to be absolutely bereft of any kind of unwholesome or anxious, neurotic feeling. Anything less than kind of totally pure, radiant love, wisdom, etc. Then we really create a lot of problems and confusion for ourselves. A monastery is a place where we allow our confusion, our defilements, to be understood. We allow all that which is unwholesome, that which is impulsive, that which is insecure, all the habits of our mind that we have lived with, that have constituted our whole being through our lifetime. A monastery is a place where we study these, where we look at them, we learn to see what these are, where do they come from, what is that which is good, how do we develop it, how do we bring that to fruition, what is there that is bad or unproductive, how do we let it end, how do we allow it to go to cessation. A monastery is a place where we learn to do these things. This is what it's for. So the point is not to just feel guilty if we're not thinking perfect thoughts and acting like saints all day and all night, but to be able to reflect upon the faults, the problems, the ugly and unharmonious aspects of our being, along with that which is beautiful, that which is loving, that which is wise and generous. So as I began to understand this, I began to see that people supporting us, people giving and being generous and devoted towards us, they didn't expect us to have totally pure minds or to be without faults or problems. That wasn't what they were expecting. They were glad that there are human beings who are ready to lay aside the choice of worldly comfort, worldly distraction, and are ready to look within, to search their own hearts, and to develop the good. This is what people support us for, not for the things that pass through our minds, but for the aspiration that we have to develop the good, to encourage us to love the good, to develop and to cherish the good. And whatever we need to go through in order to do that, that's all right. Everything that goes through our mind is all right. You know, we can go through months, years of despair and turbulent doubts and anxieties, passions, 100 years of Siberian low. It's all right. Whatever are the accumulations of our karma are, that's the material we have to work with. So the Sangha is a group, a gathering together of people who are encouraging each other to have the strength and the fortitude to keep going, to not be dismayed, to not give up, to fulfill the resolution that we have. Because I know I would have if this has been up to me, even if I'd been taught how to meditate and knew all the right things that I was supposed to do, if I didn't have the companionship and the support of the monks and the nuns, that I would have slung it in long ago. I absolutely no doubt whatsoever that I would have just given up the whole thing and hit the bottle or ended up in some little dope den in Bombay or just found a little corner to crawl away into to just forget the whole thing. I have no doubt. I mean, one has high ideals and nice illusions about life, but I know so many times in my life as a anagarika, as a novice, as a monk, that feeling of I just can't stand it anymore. I give up. I forget it. It's too much. And one just throws in one throws in one's hand and just forgets about it. I'm going to bed. I give up. I'm walking out on this. I'm getting out of here. And so many times that feeling has come up, and one of the most beautiful and important things about being in a group or being part of a whole collection of people is that then that sense of honor or that sense of affiliation with the other members of the group is what stops us and says, well, if you give up, if you throw it in, then you are also robbing other people of the opportunity to keep going. Your irresolution will contribute to the irresolution of others. And so through your weakness, you will contribute to others falling down, falling back. Now this is not a kind of threat or an intimidation, but what I've found so many times when I have been ready to give up and just chuck it in, not necessarily like leaving the monastery, but just over little things, like all-night sittings are a great teaching of this, where you're tired and you're falling asleep and you've been nodding incessantly for about 2.5 hours and your mind is sort of driveling along in a half-awake state and you think, what's the point of this? Or you're sharing a monastery, living in a monastery with someone that you can't get along with, there's constant conflict and you're just tired of thrashing away and dealing with your own feelings of irritation or aversion, or you're madly in love with someone and you can't stop thinking about them and yet you don't want to make a big thing out of it and you're trying to deal with celibacy and passionate thoughts and so on, and that quality of being part of the group and venerating, expressing devotion towards the communal standards, the communal aspiration, then that is what provides us with the check which says, no, don't give up. Don't throw it in, because the aspiration, to give up the aspiration in order just to surrender to this passing feeling would be tragic, would be a terrible sadness, and would be something that you would deeply regret later on. Because at that moment, at the moment of wanting to give up, then it's quite clear, it's quite obvious, like, I can't stand this anymore, this is too much. I'm going to explode. I've got to say something, do something, get out of here. Do something which just makes a difference. Eat something, steal something, hit someone, go run around the forest half a dozen times. Something. Something to make a difference. And then we realize that convincing nature of that thought, that feeling, it's not as absolute as it pretends to be. It proclaims itself as being something supremely solid, supremely important, real. But then the quality of the Sangha is that it touches that sense of honor in our heart, which says, you can let go of this. You don't have to believe this. You don't have to follow this. Now, one can look at this as being intimidated by the group, as a weakness, as an inhibition. Of, you know, if you were really strong, if you really had some resolve, then you wouldn't be intimidated, you wouldn't be afraid of upsetting the others or the other monks or nuns saying, tusk, 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 you know, naughty boy, naughty girl, you know, you should behave, sit in line, be good, don't do anything naughty, don't do anything that upsets the rest. And one can look at it in that way, as being just inhibition. But one can also see it in the sense of being that which truly protects and guards our heart, which is that which protects, that which is to be treasured within us, the quality of virtue, the quality of restraint, the quality of gentleness, of simplicity, of desirelessness, of fearlessness. Because when we act out of our passions, when we react to fear or desire or selfishness, jealousy, when we act on those, even though there's a certain gratification at the moment of acting, getting what we want is really, really pleasant. Like when Babu was wailing two thick doors away, wailing helplessly in the cold, and everyone is in here, all the rest of the group is in here, and there's this plaintive little wah. Then the incredible satisfaction of getting through both the enormously compassionate heart of the Venerable Buddha Daso, getting up to open both doors to let the cat in, and then the sheer delight of not only finding the Venerable Brahmano's lap, but also that he has his Sanghati wrapped around him. So you get Brahmano's lap and a woolen blanket. This purring one could feel was shaking the whole asana. The cat was just so happy. Like, wow! Not only out of the cold, but you know, this is Fat City. This is as good as it gets. And we can feel like that, you know, when we get what we want. There's a moment of satisfaction and thrill. But then, shortly after, as we are all well acquainted with, there's this feeling of, is that it? You mean, that's it? All this time I've been wailing for this? Oh no! Oh, what an idiot! What a disappointment! Just so ordinary. You know, you said what you wanted to say, or you got what you wanted to get. You've broken out. You're free. And then this is it. So this is why I feel in my heart that the Sangha is something that we need to deeply treasure. We need to really put our hearts into cherishing, treasuring, respecting as an institution, as an entity in itself, because without the Sangha, without this communal aspiration, So many of us would just fall away, we'd be caught into our desires, caught into our own worries and fears and distractions. And those qualities which are high, which are pure, which are noble within us would be lost or left in the dark or not given the opportunity to fulfill themselves as they do in this situation here. And that when we do take the trouble, when we do actually generate that reverence, that veneration in our hearts, then we have to, it's difficult. That reverence is something that we really like to not have to have around. Like, oftentimes one would really not like to be a member of the Sangha. Like, if only these other people weren't around, then I could just kind of get on with my own thing. If I didn't have a meeting to go to, if I didn't have these rules to keep, if I didn't have these other people kind of on my back or hovering in the background, then I could do my thing. So it's hard to have that respect. It frustrates the self-centered lower mind. And that frustration is hard to bear, difficult to bear. But what it does do is it opens, if we do bear with that, and we do follow the aspiration that is the spirit, the guiding force of the Sangha, then we experience the true wealth, true richness, true joy in life. We find the heart which is light, which is free, which is beautiful, which is unattainable just through the gratification of desire, of worldly ambition, of accumulation. That can mimic that same fullness, but it cannot really compete with it. It cannot really match it. So to look at the presence of the Sangha in this way is like a source of support. It's like having a sea that buoys us up. It's like being able to float. When we don't have the strength, when our resolve weakens, then we have a community, we have the Sangha, which is there to keep us afloat, that will hold us up as our own strength, as our own interest in the spiritual flags and wanes. Now, in an ideal world, we shouldn't need this. If we were all enlightened beings, if we were all truly, selfless, awakened Buddhas, we wouldn't need this. But it's because there's work to be done. It ain't over, as our great yogi would say. It ain't over. Since it ain't over, we need friends. We need support. We need those people around us. We need to connect with people who respect the good, who respect the spiritual, the pure. And those connections will be what helped keep us alive, that maintain that capacity within us for the good qualities of our hearts to flourish. So I offer these thoughts for us to consider And especially as tonight, I don't know if Ajahn Kittisaro mentioned, but we'll have an all-night sitting tonight. And so you can contemplate these words at the moment when your mind is saying, enough. That's it. Let's be reasonable. I mean, after all, there's work to be done tomorrow. And I have been busy today. And my back is hurting. My knees are bad. My stomach's a bit funny. My mind is sleepy. What are the other ones? It's too cold. As wonderful over the years as it could or should be, I've always remained a great devotee of the all-night sittings. I've always felt this is a wonderful, truly wonderful institution that we have, the all-night sitting, because it provides these opportunities for doing what you feel it's impossible to do. And this is this is where we truly awaken. Doing what you're sure you cannot do is the only time that we really break up, wake up, break up. Just doing what we know we can do is nice and is a good exercise, but doing what we can't do, doing what we feel is impossible, against all reason, against everything which is sensible, normal, to just do that which is difficult, which is we have to stretch for, something that we have to stretch for. That's where we really develop, we really understand. Like Ajahn Kittisaro was talking about his own experiences with sport, training to be a wrestler and in sport. We probably all had the same kind of experiences where your body is screaming to just stop, to rest, to give up, to just not have to feel this pain of exhaustion or pushing through physical limitation. But then that we find that we can, we have resources there, that when the thinking mind says enough, actually there's a lot more there that we can draw on. And if we always just go along with what the thinking mind says, then we might feel like we're living in a reasonable way. But from my own experience, the result is always one feels half-hearted, half-baked. One can justify things. But in your heart, you know, you could have done better. You could have done more. So to have a situation like an all-night sitting where we have the opportunity to stretch our faculties, to go against the stream of reason, of desire, of laziness, of fatigue, physical limitations, we have an opportunity to just challenge that, to go against that. And this is not just to be kind of macho or to just make life difficult for ourselves, but it's a tremendously important thing to develop that capacity to just hear the mind saying, no more, or I want to do something else, I want to be somewhere else. And to be able to just listen to that, to not be swept away by that, and to say, to recognize that, no, I think I'll just stay with this a bit longer, walk a bit longer, sit a bit longer, stay with it, what should change. And then also to recognize how much one can develop the sense of living as a group. Like for an all-night sitting is also one's own presence. Your own presence is a gift to the group. That even if something in you wants to give up and disappear, then there's a feeling of, well, if I give up, then it makes it that much easier for everybody else to. I'm encouraging others to just check out also. And I'm not saying these things to intimidate people, but just because I found so much value in it in my own life, that I've found so much joy of just being able to give up what I feel like doing in order to serve the group, in order to help encourage and be at one with the group aspiration. I found it might be painful or difficult, but there's this underswell of joy and a feeling of a great harmony and love, that one is giving, one is serving the whole, the group, as fully as one can. So on that note, I will finish and offer these thoughts for us to consider tonight.
Om Mangala Sadhu Kara.